podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Crinoid Podcast number 7. And today we're talking about the 1968 Patrick Troughton story, The Mind Robber. I have with me, on the other end of a Skype line, Martin.
Hi, Jim. How's it going?
Not half bad, thank you. And yourself?
I'm well.
Good. I'm achingly pleased to hear it. Mind Robber today, your choice, so why don't you put it into a little bit of perspective for our audience.
Okay, I shall do just that. We're looking at The Mind Robber. That's from season 6 of Doctor Who, Patrick Troughton as the Doctor, broadcast September to October 1968. Unusual in that it's a 5-part story, although when we get to talk about it we'll realise that one of them's kind of intact on the start of it. At the time, we're looking at the producer was Peter Bryant and the script editor Derek Sherwin. And it's Troughton's final season. Companions are Jamie and Zoe. And that's where we are with it, really.
Yeah, it had a working title of Manpower. Not very exciting.
No, but the story is an interesting one.
Yeah, well, The Mind Robber is a good title, I think. Quite scary. I would like to have my mind robbed. I don't think the street value is very high, for my mind.
Actually, I thought you'd already had it robbed a long time ago.
Yeah, someone kicked it around a car park and then put it back in again.
Yes, that explains a lot. Anyway, should we dive straight in?
I wish you would.
Well, it opens in the TARDIS console room with the three main characters, and it's kind of a hangover from the previous episode, The Dominators. And they're looking on at the scanner to see some, well, supposedly molten lava approaching the TARDIS, although it's actually foam, and it looks like foam as well, to be honest.
I think it's one of those things that, immersively, it's black and white, because you could just about get away with it being lava, but yes, it does look more like foam.
Yeah. Unsurprisingly, they couldn't afford real molten lava, and they didn't have the effects to produce it then, so. I mean, it's okay, I mean, you kind of get the gist of what's going on. But they're sort of dressed in their gear from the previous story. Zoe is noticeably, because she's looking very grubby in her Dominator's outfit.
A Dominatrix outfit, did you say?
I think that's what it was. I don't know how they got away with it in those days, but
amazing.
Yeah, and Jamie gets a bit excited and thinks that TARDIS is going to be destroyed by this lava. So the scene kind of plays out with him trying to convince the Doctor that they should get out of there, and then it all goes a bit pear-shaped. The Doctor starts flicking switches on the console, and then there's a problem with the fluid links, he says. Nice link back to the Daleks. And they kind of explode, and there's sort of some mercury vapour, and it sprays into everyone's faces.
Yes, the lava is continuing to approach and threatening to engulf the TARDIS, and those wretched mercury fluid links are playing up. But the Doctor realises there could be a bit of trouble, so he reveals that there is a possible way out of the situation. And that is to use the emergency unit, which, not very handily, removes the TARDIS out of the space and time dimension, out of reality itself. Which, that's got to be the last straw in any situation, surely.
Yeah, and the Doctor is very reluctant to use it, but Jamie and Zoe kind of convince him to do so, don't they? Because they seem more concerned than he does.
They don't want to get fried.
Yeah, I think the line is, sort of, Jamie says, has the TARDIS ever been immersed in lava before? And the Doctor kind of... does his startled face and kind of goes along with it. Actually, I should just point out one thing here before we move on. The episode itself, when the titles are coming up, doesn't have a writer assigned to it, does it? Because this one was written by Derek Sherwin, the script editor, as opposed to the rest of the story, which was written by Peter Ling. But it's not credited. It was certainly not credited at the start, as they normally are.
Yeah, this is a result of the Dominators ending up being in episodes shorter than it should have been through lack of plot. Insufficient plot to fill the allotted 6 episodes. So that became a 5-parter, and this was originally a 4-parter. It had to become a 5-parter to make up the difference.
I think there was insufficient plot to fill about 2 episodes in that story, to be honest.
But back to the mind rubber. So yes, this is, and it shows a little bit, a filler episode and done on a very limited budget. Normally first episodes have a higher budget than others because you have to strike up new sets and all the rest of it. And the instruction normally is to keep to those sets for the rest of the story. So that kind of budget went to episode two rather than episode one in this case. So you ended up with them having to look behind the sofa and find some props and beg, borrow and steal stuff, which as we'll come to discuss, it becomes a little bit obvious in places. But yeah, this is an extra episode.
Yeah, but I think it's it stands alone on its own. And it's very, very well, I think.
Yeah, it's nice and creepy.
Mm. Anyway, so the Doctor ends up using this emergency unit and he doesn't know what's going to happen. Basically, the TARDIS disappears under the foam and it kind of disappears. So there's a strange noise and some sort of shaking, isn't there? And then everything seems okay for a bit. They realise there's no readings on any of the meters on the TARDIS console. The scanner isn't showing anything. The Doctor says that's because we're nowhere.
Yes, which is quite chilling.
Mm.
At this point, Zoe turns up in the power room, which the Doctor has retreated to, which I'm not sure we've seen that before, have we, in the history of the show and the interior of the TARDIS?
No, I don't think so.
But it's kind of pretty much adjoining the main console room. And Zoe by this time has changed into her famous spangly catsuit.
Yeah.
And you know, she wonders what's going on out there. The Doctor says it isn't really safe to go outside because he's got absolutely no idea what's going to be out there.
Meanwhile, back in the console room, Jamie is transfixed. As he can see on the scanner, a picture of his homeland, Scotland, and he hears bagpipes and he's all taken by it.
There's a kind of mixed shot, isn't there, of his face and the image on the scanner of the Scottish Islands, which is clearly some kind of postcard. Unfortunately, it lingers a little bit too long and Fraser Hines is really struggling to keep a smile going, I thought. A little bit glassy smile by the end of it.
And Zoe arrives, and as she does so, the vision on the scanner vanishes as Jamie tries to convince her what he's seen. And then while he's kind of distracted, she sees her home city on the scanner, which then promptly vanishes as well. So they end up in an argument as to where they are.
Yeah, it's interesting that the image chosen for Zoe's future city in the far-flung future of the year 2000 is the actual city of Brasilia, which was in its day, and it was built in the late 60s, and it was considered a hyper-modern, futuristic city, and that's an image of that they use for her home world. So both of them have seen their home world, and neither one believes them because they never see the image that the other sees, so they have a bit of an argument. Zoe wants to go out and see her home world, but Jamie says, not without the Doctor, and goes off to find him.
Mm. It's got a note to self here, to mention the roundels in the background.
That aren't very... Well, they're round, but they don't have any depth, do they?
No, it's a pretty poor photocopy, which they used a lot throughout Troughton and Hartnell before him. But you tended to get away with it in the old VHS days. But now they've cleaned up all the, you know, they use this new process. Well, it's not new anymore, the sort of cleaning up process they do on all the DVDs, etc. But it's very, very noticeable, this sort of photocopied background they use.
Yeah, it is. Vidfire is not really forgiving on these.
No.
They're flats, aren't they? They're basically blow-ups of the TARDIS roundels, but they're less bulky and easier to strike up and stuff. So that's why they do it. It gives them a bit more room in the studio, and the Lime Grove studios are well known for how small they are. So that's one of the ways they gave themselves a little bit more room to work with.
They normally sort of have one decent bit of proper scenery, which they tend to do most of the shooting against, and then they have the photocopied bit just so you get the depth of the console room. But in this case, they just have that. They don't even have a decent bit of scenery for it.
Well, they have a bit of the door, don't they? The wall with the door in it, and that's it. And the rest of it is all being photocopied.
Anyway, so Jamie goes off to get the Doctor. Zoe again sees her home appear on the scanner and can't wait for them to come back. So she manages to open the doors and goes outside and promptly sort of disappears into some sort of mist.
The scanner turns white at that point as well, doesn't it?
Mm.
As does the outside world that she stepped into. Jamie's in the power room explaining the visions to the Doctor, and they return to the control room to find that Zoe's gone. Jamie's about to launch himself out and follow her, but the Doctor stops him. Thinking it must be a trap because they've both seen, you know, images that are designed to kind of tempt them out of the TARDIS, and the Doctor's highly suspicious of that, obviously, as they're two different images, a bit of a giveaway.
Mm.
And at that point, the warning light for the emergency unit that has plonked them out of normal space-time starts flashing, indicating that it's going to automatically return them to reality. Of course, if that happens without Zoe on board, then she's going to be stranded out there.
Mm. So Jamie sort of rushes out to find her, despite the doctor trying to stop him, and he promptly vanishes as well. And the warning, this sort of klaxon starts sounding. And you get a strange high-pitched noise as well. The doctor sort of puts his hands to his ears and says, "Who are you? Where are you?" So there's obviously something attacking him. He feels that, you know, there's some alien force inside the ship, which he's kind of fighting against. This is the bit where it gets all surreal, because up until this point, it's, you know, fairly standard. But from here on in, this episode really goes a bit weird, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah, well, we then see Zoe in the Blue Peter studio, don't we?
Yeah.
It's an entirely white studio.
Luckily, the elephant hasn't been in there yet.
So. Yes, it wouldn't be entirely white anymore. But, it's a whited-out studio. Quite effective, really. But again, I think this is another thing that suffers from better clarity of picture, because I think on the VHS version of that, it looked more like a white nothingness.
Yeah, whereas you can see the corners in this country, really. But
you can, unfortunately, but they, you know, I think they did the best job they could.
Yeah,
but Zoe's calling for Jamie, and Jamie tracks her down by hearing a voice, and they both find each other. But they realise that they can't then see the TARDIS, and they can't remember how to get back to it. So they decide to shout for the Doctor and hope that he will be around to hear their voices and guide them back to him and the TARDIS. But the Doctor's still suffering this psychic attack on board the TARDIS.
Yeah, that's right. He's having to lie down in a chair, isn't he? Yeah, so Jamie and Zoe, they feel like they're being watched, and we see these white robots. I hear this kind of the noise that you get when these robots appear throughout the story. Jamie and Zoe, for some reason, can't see them at this stage, but the viewer can. We get, again, this bit where Zoe sees her home city, and Jamie convinces her it's an illusion, and then Jamie hears his bagpipes and sees Scotland, and Zoe convinces him it's not... Yeah, it's this sort of to-in and fro-in thing. And then Zoe slaps his face, which is quite amusing.
Yeah, well, he deserved it.
Yeah.
But, these white robots are quite interesting, I think, aren't they? They aren't actually white because of the, as we've mentioned in previous podcasts, if you have flat white surfaces, and back in those days they used to flare up on screen. So these white robots, I think, are yellow with grey arms. So they had to be painted pale colours that weren't white to avoid this flaring problem. They're actually, because of the, you know, the budget restrictions, they're actually taken from an episode of the Out of the Unknown series, an episode called The Prophet. And they were actually supposed to be quite comical in that story. And as a result, they don't really look that menacing in this one. But they're all right. They're quite good, I think.
They don't look menacing particularly, but I think this kind of music you get with them, well, this noise you get when they arrive, it's more eerie rather than scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good. Disquieting, isn't it? The way I first came across the white robots was with the free Weetabix figures that you used to get in packs of Weetabix in the mid-70s.
Mm.
And because they didn't appear in my Doctor Who monster book, I had no idea what story they were from. And it was many, many years later that I found out it was from the Mind Robin.
Was it? That may have been a later set of Weetabix cards where you used to get the cut-out thing on the back of the box where you could stand them in a kind of a setting, couldn't you? Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was this series, yeah.
That was this one, was it?
So, yeah, you had the little scenery at the back of the box, and you could move your figures around and make little plays with them in that. The next time the Weetabix got involved, they had those kind of board games, didn't they, with cut-out figures.
That's right. Agador was my favourite.
wasn't he everybody's?
Probably. Anyway, back to the Mind Robin. Yeah, so the robots kind of close in on Jamie and Zoe, so they kind of surround them. And suddenly they're both dressed in white, and you hear a scream, presumably from Zoe, and it cuts back to the Doctor in his chair, and he kind of sees them, an image of them kind of beckoning him towards them, and this voice speaking to him, telling him to follow them. But again, he's fighting against it, saying he's not going to give in, and the voice is saying, yes, you will, you will. You get these kind of psychedelic spiral patterns, and you hear Zoe screaming again. It's all really, really weird, isn't it?
Well, there's a lot of Zoe screaming, that's for sure, and mostly it seems to be quite pointless. Can't even quite work out what she's screaming about. But it's odd here, because you think she's kind of screaming because she sees herself and Jamie in white beckoning to them. But then you kind of think, no, I'm actually beckoning to the Doctor, aren't I, to try and get him out of the TARDIS. This ray that the robots seem to be firing is doing something, but we don't really know what. So it's all kind of disorientating.
Mm.
But quite creepy. I mean, the fact that they're suddenly dressed in white is quite a striking image, I think.
Yeah, and eventually the Doctor kind of gives in and he goes out into the mist outside. And as he steps out, you get a shot from outside of him coming out and the TARDIS itself is white.
Yeah, that's a brilliant brilliant image, that.
Yeah, and I think he's still in his kind of black costume, isn't he? So he's kind of the odd one out. He's obviously the one that hasn't yet been taken over. And you get this odd scene where Jamie and Zoe are flashing between a normal and a negative image. You hear the Doctor's voice, although you don't actually see him speaking, telling them it's not real, and you know they have to follow him and come back to the TARDIS. More of these sort of psychedelic spirally things, which I presume are coming from the robots. And eventually the Doctor grabs them and pulls and manhandles them back to the TARDIS. At which point we see on the scanner, producer Peter Bryant. Did you notice that?
Yeah, for the eagle-eyed, I mean, I didn't notice it until I saw it on the info text on the DVD, but apparently this is all teed up, ready for rolling the credits at the end of the episode. Talk about breaking the fourth wall. There's the the name of the producer of the show they are in on the TARDIS scanner. So luckily, it does kind of need pointing out, really, than being totally obvious, which is, I suppose, how it happened in the first place.
Well, they're already in the land of fiction, so it does kind of fit in. So.
Yeah, anything goes. Yeah, one of their creators is getting involved.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they get back into the TARDIS and they're back into the normal full colour, aren't they? Or full black and white, I should say. And Jamie has a bit of a sit down, doesn't he? And appears to have a nightmare involving a horse, because you can hear a horse in the background. And he tells the Doctor and Zoe, who are kind of arguing about what to do next, about his dream, which is of a white horse with a horn on its head.
Mm.
As he gets up to talk about that, there's an extremely obvious boom shadow, isn't there, on the wall preceding him as he gets up. But Zoe recognises the description as a unicorn.
Mm.
So that mythology obviously still exists in her future time, and sure enough it did. People still knew what unicorns were in 2000, so they were right.
Yeah. The TARDIS seems to be losing power. Doctor uses this emergency power unit to try and boost it so they can get away. Meanwhile, Jamie's having this dream and the unicorns.
I'm sure it's Freudian.
It must be, I think. Yeah. And the Doctor puts his hands to his head, and you hear this sound. It's kind of an alien vibration. And the Doctor tells everyone to concentrate. He gets Zoe and Jamie to read the figures off of this power meter to try and get them to concentrate. But the noise keeps increasing, and it cuts to a scene of the TARDIS in space. I think this is great, this bit. And it's kind of spinning slowly around, and suddenly it explodes and splits into four parts, doesn't it? Well, six parts, probably. The sides fly off in the bottom, top and bottom. And then you get an image of Jamie and Zoe, or plasticine versions of them, hanging onto a spinning TARDIS console, just kind of in space.
Well, I've watched that scene many, many times, and it wasn't until I saw the info text about them being these plasticine models that I actually noticed that they were. So it must have been after this effect.
And it was, yeah. I mean, certainly. I mean, same as you, I watch it with the info text on just to see what it brings up. And it was the same. I mean, I've seen it loads of times. But once it's pointed out, you can see it, but it still looks reasonably good.
Yeah, it's a decent effect. And it's quite another really striking image is the console adrift and spinning in space with those two clinging to it. It's quite freaky, really.
Then you get a close-up of them, sort of Jamie clinging on, and suddenly Zoe's lying across the console for some reason. And she sees the Doctor and shouts to Jamie, and then screams for absolutely no reason whatsoever, as far as I can see.
That's a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah, the Doctor's just kind of slowly revolving with his eyes closed, which is obviously horrific to Zoe for some reason. The console just kind of slowly disappears into the mist, and the episode ends. I must say, it's probably one of the weirdest episodes that I've seen.
Yeah, it's very odd because there's very little. Well, explain the fact that they're now out of reality, and suddenly all this weird stuff is fair game, isn't it? That nothing follows any logical laws, and yeah, it's quite a freaky episode and quite a striking one.
Yeah, I could, I really liked it. I have to say, I think it works really well. Like I say, it's a kind of a filler to the next episode to play with, and not much of a budget, but they did it really well, I thought.
By today's standards, it's a little bit slow, but it's stuffed with so many interesting images and ideas that, it's a bit of a triumph, I think, for Derek Sherwin to have pulled that one out of the hat.
Yeah, definitely. So we're into part two. Interesting, that, actually, the length of these episodes, because some of them are quite short, aren't they?
Yeah.
Some of them are kind of barely over the 20-minute mark. So, obviously they didn't quite have enough script to fill five, but I think it still works. There's plenty enough going on. And you would think that they could probably come up with one or two more ideas with it.
I imagine maybe it's budgetary that they've done as much as they could with the cash that they had. But you're right, in a sort of environment like this, there's all sorts they could be doing. Mm. And they do a lot, and maybe any more would just be overkill. There are a lot of different characters and stuff that pop up, aren't there? Maybe it's about right, I don't know. But anyway, episode two, after the recap, we see Jamie wandering through what looks like a forest. He comes across a very red-cheeked redcoat. Jamie's just about to attack him with his knife, but the redcoat turns around and shoots him. As he does so, Jamie turns into a life-size cardboard cutout, doesn't he?
Yeah. It's a good story behind this one, where Fraser Hines had chicken pox, apparently, didn't he? And they had to come up with a way of getting him out of the episode at short notice. And it's a very clever way of doing it. Most of the time, they would have just kind of knocked him out and... a bit like the episode in the moon base where he just spends one episode asleep because they haven't got enough for three companions to do.
Yeah.
But rather than that here, they actually get somebody else to play him. And they get a very clever way of doing it as well.
Yeah, it will come to in quite a short time. We then see Zoe elsewhere in the same forest, by the looks of it, shouting for Jamie. The continuity person needs to be shot here because she's wearing a much longer hairpiece than she had in episode one. But episode one was actually shot after the other four episodes, so certainly Zoe's wandering along. She appears suddenly to be trapped within some stone walls, doesn't she? They appear from nowhere. But then suddenly in one of the walls, an old sort of medieval-style studded oak door appears and then opens. And she walks through into the darkness and tumbles into the blackness and screams again.
Mm. The next thing we see is a shot of a kind of control room with some kind of monitor screens. And you hear a voice, and whoever's speaking obviously knows the doctor. He's saying that the doctor has eluded him. He must not yet be completely under his control. You don't actually see who's saying this yet, but obviously this is the power behind what's been going on.
Yeah, it's a classic staple in Doctor Who, although it may be the first time it's shown in the show's history, but it certainly gets a bit more of a run out in the 70s and 80s. It's the shot of someone you can't see but watching what the Doctor's companions are doing from a bank of screens, which crops up quite a lot in the future. But it's always a bit creepy, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good.
But it looks like the companions are under his control, but the Doctor isn't. And he's kind of ordering his minions, whoever they may be, to try and find him, aren't they?
Yeah. So we cut back to the Doctor, who's just coming round in the forest. He hears Zoe and Jane calling for him.
Well, she hears Zoe and a Scottish voice.
True, yes. Which, is Jamie. I didn't get it wrong.
No, it's Jamie. It's just not Fraser Hines.
typical Patrick Troughton fashion, he gets all flustered when they start calling it him at the same time. And the great, oh, no, 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 no. he gets them to call one at a time so he can figure out where they are. It's kind of dark at the stage. And I think the Doctor sort of makes a comment about it being dark, and suddenly the lights are turned on as if by magic, aren't they?
That's right, and he thanks the unknown person at the light switch for doing it, doesn't he? He knows that there's at that point that there's someone out there following quite closely what he's doing and saying, by the sounds of it. And then you see these sort of mechanical-looking feet, don't you? And a cut to another part, presumably of the same figure, which seems to be kind of a roving searchlight. And then you go back to where the master is behind these screens, and on one of the screens you seem to be seeing what that light is scanning at that time. So you kind of twig that that is some kind of surveillance device for this chap.
Mm. These mystery legs disappear. And when they're gone, another character turns up. This time it's played by Bernard Horsfall, who we know very well from The Deadly Assassin from a few podcasts back.
Yeah, Chancellor Garth.
Yeah, and he is, well, he's basically pointing a some kind of pistol at the doctor and talking to him in some strange language. He is dressed in sort of, I don't know, how would you describe it? Some sort of
18th century sort of stuff, I suppose. A tricorn hat and all that kind of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, and the doctor tries to speak to him in French, and then he tries him on English. And luckily for us and him, he does speak English. We don't find out who he is at this stage, but he's speaking very sort of flowery language, isn't he?
A bit like Jondar from Vengeance on Varus.
Yeah, but far more convincingly. Yeah. So they have a bit of a chat. Don't really know what's going on. Eventually, the doctor convinces him to put his pop gun away, and he mentions the master. For us watching it, you think, oh, the master. But of course, it's not that master.
It's another master.
Someone else, yes. So eventually, this chap wanders off, and the doctor's next confronted by some kind of mischievous children who kind of jump out from nowhere and start giving him riddles to solve.
They're kind of E. Nesbitt types, aren't they? Edward in Children's, like the five children in it and all that kind of stuff. And they're quite tiresome, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But it's an interesting little scene. They do the pinch me gag, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
And, again, you've got the trout and get free. Oh, don't do that. No, stop it. Anyway, end up, what is Mighty the Sword or something? One of them points a sword at him. When the doctor gets it right, they throw it in the air and the sword disappears and a dictionary comes back down again. Which is very apt, this story, because it's all about words. They say, oh, you may be suitable, and then they run away, which could be kind of a throwaway line, but it's actually quite apt, really, for what happens later on.
Yeah, it looks like he's passed some kind of a test by getting these, well, that particular riddle right, doesn't he? And he chucks his dictionary down a well, doesn't he?
Which has disappeared from there.
Yeah, and there's a strange, sinister laugh comes out. But he hears Jamie's voice, but then finds the cardboard cutout of Jamie. And then he looks around, there's a locked safe, and the wishing well has suddenly appeared. And he makes a nice joke about wishing wells, doesn't he?
Hello? What's this? Safe? Locked, of course. And a wishing well. I wish. Wish I believed in wishing wells.
And he chucks the book down as well, and then there's a sinister laugh comes up. But he gets some pictorial clues come up, don't they? And he works out from them that a message Jamie is safe and well. But the face on Jamie's cardboard cutout disappears. So he's got his blank face. But at the same time, a board with some kind of magnetic identical face parts appears, doesn't it? And the doctor twigs that has to put the right face parts on the cardboard cutout to bring Jamie back to life.
Mm, that's right. Yeah, that, I mean, they're not, real bits of face, I have to point out. It's kind of photocopies. Yeah, that would be horrible.
And unhygienic, I imagine.
Mm, exactly. Imagine if you got somebody else's nose. Oh.
Well, imagine if they had a cold.
Oh, dear. No. I don't want to. Anyway, of course, Trout being Trout, he gets it wrong. And so we end up with a different Jamie. Jamie with a different face, as played by Hamish Wilson.
Well, different everything else, presumably.
Well, I don't know. He certainly had a different face. I couldn't see the rest of him, really. But from his knees.
Yes. I'm not familiar enough with Fraser Hines' knees to say yay or nay on that one. But, Jamie doesn't believe that he's got a different face, so the doctor shows him a mirror, and then he does believe.
Mm.
But it's clear from the conversation that Jamie describes what's happened to him since, they disappeared from the TARDIS. And it's clear from that the doctor didn't actually know that the TARDIS broke up, and he's quite concerned, naturally.
Yeah, exactly. They hear Zoe calling out, don't they? And they go looking for her, and they find this door in a brick wall, and the Doctor realises it's just been painted on to the wall rather than being actually being a door. And of course, he has a think about it, and he goes, when is a door not a door? When it's a jar. And the door disappears, and you see Zoe in this giant jam jar. And the Doctor and Jamie find this very amusing, just kind of laughing at her. And they help her out by basically putting her hand through the paper top. It's like, why didn't she do it herself? She must be extremely weak, that's all I can say.
Well, that's a good point. As it turns out in a later episode, she appears to be extremely strong, but more of that later. But, they help her out, and she's obviously aghast that Jamie has a different face. The Doctor kind of explains what happened, but without explaining that he made an enormous cock-up of getting Jamie's face wrong. And he says that they're in a place where nothing is impossible, basically.
Mm. The Doctor helps Jamie to shin up one of the trees to try and figure out where they are, to see if he can see anything.
I notice the direction here is quite carefully done, so as not to give away the answer to the age-old question about guilt. That might be a way of telling the Jamie's part.
Yes, thankfully we were spared that.
Well, he's a McCrimmon, isn't he? If it was 2 quart-pounders, it would have been a McDonald. Enough of that, or we'll have to use an explicit tag on this one.
So Jamie's up on top of this kind of tree, which he realises is actually in the shape of the letter S. And, in fact, all the trees in this forest are letters, which spell out, words. We see this kind of shot from above, which isn't particularly convincing, but you kind of get the gist of what's going on. And all these words make up kind of sayings or proverbs, such as in for a penny, in for a pound, look before you leap, that kind of thing.
Obviously, yeah, this is a forest of letters. That shot you get makes all the forest look very kind of shallow, doesn't it? The letters aren't really deep. And on the DVD, the rather flamboyant designer on this story, Evan Hercules, says that he wasn't very happy with that. But to be fair, with that budget, he had a Herculean task to make it look good.
Right, I'm going.
Can you see how I made it funny?
I'm leaving this podcast. I'm going to another.
No one will have you. I'm confident of that.
Yes, probably right. Anyway, yeah, I mean, it's not a very good shot.
Yeah, it's not a great shot, but, you get the idea, and they don't linger on it either. So, But Jamie sees an exit through all these words, which presumably is the margin or one end of the page or something. So they strike up in that direction when Jamie's come down from the top of the tree.
Yeah, and the Bernard Horsfall character reappears.
They have yet another fruitless conversation.
Throughout the story, we get a load of fruitless conversations with Gulliver. Although, does he? He answers the questions and moves the plot along a little, but, as a viewer, you're going to get the idea. But, actually, all three of the regulars are very thick in this story. They take so long to pick up on anything.
Yeah, it's true, yeah.
Same mistakes over and over again. It is a bit annoying, to be honest.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a result of trying to fill out episodes. But, you think that they'd be bright enough to pick up on things a lot quicker than they do. But particularly about the identity of this stranger. But it comes clear that this chap can't actually see the soldiers, these mechanical creatures that are after the Doctor and his companions. And as a result, he kind of gets them caught, doesn't he?
Mm.
We find out these are giant clockwork soldiers who've got massive keys in their backs, and they move like clockwork. And they take the Doctor and the companions away to this kind of dark area of the forest. And then you hear the chap behind the monitors saying the mission is accomplished. And then they're suddenly rushed out by a unicorn.
They are. Zoe and Jamie are very panicked by it. The Doctor's trying to tell them to stand still. And the unicorn rushes towards them and the episode ends. Just an aside, we might want to pick up on this later. The Bernard Horsfall character, we find out later, is Gulliver. And his dialogue is from the book Gulliver's Travels. So everything he says is from the book. I quite like that, actually, throughout the story, although it is a bit annoying, as you just said, that the conversations really don't really go anywhere. But I like the idea of it.
It's a clever idea, definitely, because, he's not a character in his own right. He's a piece of fiction, therefore. It turns out later on Peter Ling starts adding some of his own phrases in. But, it's all in the same style, and you'd have to be a pedant to get worked up about that one. But, it's a very clever idea. And in a way, it makes him more enigmatic, doesn't it? Because that you never get quite a straight answer because he has to say something that roughly answers the question, but in the words of Jonathan Swift. So, yeah, it's a very good idea.
The other thing I just wanted to bring up is the whole thing feels really quite sort of pantomimey, especially Zoe, I think. There's a feel about it that's, I can't quite put my finger on what it is. It's almost kind of childish, a lot of it. But it kind of just about gets away with it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk a bit later at the end about audience reaction to this one. But yeah, I mean, it's a different style of story. I suppose The Celestial Toymaker was kind of as near as we got to this kind of fantasy stuff before this one. And I wonder if the performances are altered slightly as a result of this strange fantasy world. But to be honest, Wendy Padbury's a little bit kind of school drama at the best of times, isn't she? And I remember when Matthew Waterhouse's Adric was getting loads of hassle from fans who didn't like him, I think Wendy Padbury was the one he pointed out, saying, you know, when they're in the 60s, they were like they're in a pantomime. And you can see his point in this story at the very least.
Mm. Anyway, moving on to part three. We've got the unicorn charging at the main characters, and Doctor convinces Jamie and Zoe to shout, "It doesn't exist." And sure enough, it kind of vanishes to be replaced by a cardboard cutout of itself.
Yeah, although they later describe it as a statue, don't they? And it ain't. It's a cardboard cutout.
Yeah, it's certainly a cardboard cutout. Yeah. I thought it was supposed to be a cardboard cutout. I must have missed that line.
Well, I thought it was, but yeah, they talk about it as having turned into a statue when it gets later down the line. But yeah, the story behind this unicorn is quite funny. They asked to be supplied with a white horse. They actually got a brown horse, which they then had to use a military whitewash on to turn it white. And then they all sorts of trouble keeping the horde on, so to speak.
Yeah, I had that problem myself.
There's a new pill you can get these days, Marty. But the production team, to add insult to this injury, got a fantastic first take on their horse charging, but they found out they'd forgotten to put any film in the camera.
Schoolboy error.
Yeah, so I had to do that one again. So all in all, not their finest hour.
Mm.
But it actually looks pretty good on screen, I think. And the horn, I think, looks quite good. Even Hercules was worried about whether, you know, the straps that they put around their horse's face to keep the horn on were going to be visible. And they aren't visible at all, as far as I can see.
No, that's so very effective.
I think they've done a very good job on that.
Yeah. They have a quick chat about who's been causing these things to happen to them, and Doctor sort of comments that it must be a fantastic mind. He cuts to the master, who's this character in the control room, who kind of returns the compliment, doesn't he?
That's right.
He thinks the Doctor must be supremely intelligent because he's managed to work things out so quickly, even though they are very, very simplistic.
Yes.
Like putting together somebody's face from a three-piece jigsaw, which he actually managed to get wrong.
Not his finest hour.
But anyway, obviously the standard of intelligence on this fictional world is very low if the Doctor's managed to show supreme intelligence at this point.
It's like the modern GCSEs, isn't it?
I guess, yeah.
Not like the ancient O-levels we took. Yeah, so the new Jamie comes across his red coat again, doesn't he, as they set out. And again he's shot, and again he turns into cardboard.
He shoots his face clean off this time, doesn't he?
That's right, yeah, there's no interim on this one.
No.
Shot his face clean off, hanging off a tree afterwards, I think. And the little panel with the identikit face parts appears again. And Zoe at this point realises what has happened, and the Doctor made a right gnaws up of the first of these tests. He gets it right with some kind of tacit and rather annoyed help from her. Which is a really nice scene, I think, that.
Yeah, it is.
And Troughton is brilliant in it. Jamie appears.
Yeah, we get Fraser back.
Then they find an oak door. It looks like the first one, but I'm guessing it isn't the same one. And they open that and they find themselves in a candlelit and cobwebbed room. And the door slams behind them in true horror film style.
Yeah, they find a ball of twine on the floor, which is going to come in handy, because it's clear that they're in this kind of labyrinth. You see the master watching them on the screen, and there's this kind of layout of a labyrinth. They use this twine to kind of, they tie it to the doorknob so that they'll be able to follow it back if they get lost or whatever. So they start heading through this maze And they reach the point where the twine runs out, so they have to figure out what to do. So Zoe's been working out that they're basically making their way towards the centre, that they've been taking. I think, I can't remember what she says, that, you know, second left, third right, blah, blah, blah.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because she says that there's a kind of arithmetical progression to the way they've been going through the maze. When you look at where they started the maze and where they end up, there isn't. They do about two rights and there they are.
Yeah, the maze on the scanner is very simplistic. You know, you just basically go in a straight line, you'll get there.
Pretty much.
But anyway, they leave Jamie there while the Doctor and Zoe head a bit further in, and they eventually reach the centre, and they find these bones on the floor. And then they hear this roar, and Zoe sort of suggesting it could be, you know, the legend of the Minotaur, which of course it is. That's what it turns out to be. There's a great shot of Troughton's face when they hear this roar. Oh, it's great. And then you see the shadow of the Minotaur on the wall. It's much more menacing than when you actually see it.
That is true. It's very true. But it's interesting that they find these bones and some animal tracks, don't they? Mm. But then you think, the Minotaur's only got a bull's head, so why would it be leaving animal tracks?
Oh, very good.
See, maybe I've got a brilliant mind and should be dragged into the mind robber's domain.
Possibly, but I don't think so.
No, it seems unlikely. Yeah, they put two and together with the twine and the sound of the bull and the silhouette. And then suddenly, for some reason, they see one of those 1970s troll dolls, don't they? Rather than a Minotaur.
Yeah, it's quite grotesque, but...
But it ain't a bull's head, is it?
It ain't a bull's head, no.
And that was apparently a bit of a stock prop, and don't it show?
It cuts back to Jamie. He hears the Clockwork Soldiers approaching again. You get, as with the white robots, they get their own distinctive sound, don't they, when they're approaching. And he kind of hides, but, you know, this soldier appears. It's just one of them, actually. And he figures out that it's this kind of light in its chest that is the means of seeing, which...
It's on his hat, isn't it?
Yeah. It's on his hat, sorry, yes. So he takes off his jacket and he puts the jacket over the head of the soldier to blind it, and he makes his escape. But back in the centre of the maze, the Doctor and Zoe are having a conversation that we get a lot in this story as to whether or not the Minotaur is mythical or whether it actually exists. So having decided the unicorn's mythical, it doesn't exist, they do the same with the Minotaur, and of course it vanishes. To be honest with you, that is already starting to wear a bit, but we do get it several times more. One of the things about this story, it does kind of distract, I think.
Yeah, it's a little bit repetitious, isn't it? They deal with most hazards in exactly the same way. Another thing comes with repetitious is, first they find Jamie's jacket, don't they? And then they bump into Gulliver again.
Yeah, and again, they don't really get much out of him. He talks again a little bit about the master. I think he tells them where they can find him, doesn't he? He describes this castle on a hill or something. Mm. That's about all you get out of him.
But the Doctor actually... Finally twigs, isn't he?
Yeah, he realises who he is.
Yeah, and he actually manages to kind of speak in unison with Gulliver. One of his lines, doesn't he? Obviously, a line that the Doctor remembers from Gulliver's travels. So he's also twigged that Gulliver really only speaks the lines that were written for him. He finally twigs that this is a world of fiction.
He does, yeah.
No thingamy, Sherlock.
Yeah. We cut to a rare piece of film footage of Jamie, and he's going along this side of this kind of rock face, isn't he, being chased by one of the soldiers, a slow-speed chase. And he kind of climbs up this rock ledge to evade this rather ineffective soldier, and he kind of reaches a ledge a little way up where he comes across a kind of a sheer rock face, which doesn't seem to have anywhere to go.
Yes, and it's a nice piece of this because it is some location. It's any piece of location footage, isn't it? Well, I think the unicorn was shot on location, but you can't see what's behind it. So that doesn't really count from a viewer's point of view. And I think the director, Dave Maloney, makes the most of it, really. Some really nice camera angles as Fraser Hines is climbing up these rocks. And it turns out this clockwork soldier that's after him is actually played by his brother and flatmate at the time, Ian Hines.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So Jamie is on this ledge, having evaded this soldier. And I think he says to himself, what I really need is, well, something like that, doesn't he? And suddenly this kind of rope, or what appears to be a rope, comes tumbling down to him. And he uses this rope to kind of climb up this rock face. And he climbs up, he gets to the top, and there's this kind of tower, and there's a window in it, and he kind of goes over to that. And this young lady appears, who turns out to be the Princess Rapunzel. It's her hair that he's been using as a rope. She complains about him tugging too hard. He sniggers.
She does. For now, for now. Yeah, she's well 60s looking, she is, Rapunzel.
She is.
She's disappointed that Jamie isn't a prince, but she lets him into the tower anyway.
Mm.
At that point, she disappears completely, and Jamie finds himself apparently not in a medieval tower, but in a futuristic control room. And there's a screen showing the first page of Treasure Island, and there's some kind of audio device playing the beginning of what appears to be an audio book of Little Women.
Yeah.
He sees also some cabinets kind of lining the room, all marked with names of works of fiction like Vanity Fair, Pip and the Pendulum, Swallows and Amazons, Black Beauty, Martin Chuzzlewit, and Don Quixote, or however it's pronounced this week. But he also finds a ticker tape machine. He starts reading the output of this machine, and it seems to be a kind of a real-time novelization of what he and the Doctor have been doing, which is quite freaky.
So he's reading about what's going on with the Doctor and Zoe in the labyrinth, and he reads that they've gone back to the centre of the labyrinth, where a new terror awaits them. So it cuts back to these two, where they are confronted by a statue of Medusa with snakes for hair. The snakes kind of come to life. I actually quite like that effect. It's like a stop-motion thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a Ray Harryhausen style, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it looks quite good, really.
It does, yeah.
It's supposed to be sort of a living statue kind of thing, and I think, yeah, it's quite effective.
I do notice that the snake's entirely stationary when you get a long shot of Medusa.
Well, yeah.
Fair enough.
So Jamie continues to read off what's going on from his ticker tape machine. One glance from her eyes would turn them to stone. So Dr. and Zoe are looking away as the Medusa kind of approaches. The Doctor's, you know, saying to Zoe that Medusa's not real. But Zoe believes that she is real, and Medusa comes closer and closer, and she reaches out her arm to sort of touch Zoe on the shoulder. And that's where the episode ends. Now, as I sort of said a minute ago, this is the third time they've used this trick, and, you know, it is really getting tedious at this point. Mm-hmm. You know what's going to happen. He's going to eventually convince her, and it will disappear. You know, they needed to come up with something different. That's the problem with this story, I think. It's quite strong, other than the fact that they keep reusing the same.
Yeah, this is a bit tricky, this one. But that's where episode 3 ends, isn't it? Episode 4 starts. There's a bit of a Flash Gordon moment here, isn't there? Because the Medusas were like reaching out to Zoe at the end of episode 3. But she's actually touching Zoe, trying to turn her face towards her to look at her at the beginning of episode 4, which I think would have been a lot better cliffhanger. Because she then the choice is not even hers, whether she looks into the face of Medusa or not. And the Doctor's saying, you know, don't look into her eyes. But then suddenly Medusa is some feet away again, isn't she? So, yeah, it all gets a bit messed up. At this point, Jamie reads off the ticker tape machine that the Doctor finds a sword and slays the Medusa. And back to the Doctor and Zoe, the Doctor does find a sword, but realises he can't slay something that doesn't exist. So he gets his mirror out again. And it's not clear whether it's the same old trick of, you know, if you realise she doesn't exist, then she doesn't. Or whether or not he actually does. Is it Theseus who took on the Medusa? I can't remember. Or Perseus. But and then they reflected the Medusa's image back at her and turned her back into a statue in the myth. And it looks like that might have been what happens to here, although they're still kind of banging on about saying that she's not real. So if they have used a different tactic here, it isn't really that clear that they have.
No, I think you're right. I think that is a different tactic, but it's still the same thing. You know, Zoe knows that the Medusa is a myth. All they've got to do is say she's not real, and that'd be the end of it. It's just a bit annoying. Okay, fair enough, they use a slightly different way of dealing with it. But there's no need, there's no reason for it, because, they've already done it twice, they know what to do.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Maybe Zoe couldn't convince herself this time around. That's where the mirror came into play.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's mucked up the Master's plan, and the ticker tape starts reading out, cancel, cancel, cancel the doctor test report failure. And at this point, Jamie tries to leave the room, but he sets off an alarm, and a grill comes down over the window that he came in at.
Mm.
And with tedious inevitability, Gulliver appears again.
Talking more nonsense.
Yeah, without Gulliver's help, Jamie hides, and a troop of white robots come through.
Yeah, Gulliver, again, because you can't see them, but this time he doesn't give Jamie away, thankfully. Jamie comes out of the closet, so to speak, where he's been hiding. He cuts to a painting of the Citadel, which actually is, I think, it's reasonably good. It's a painting, but it's okay, it doesn't.
Well, I was thinking about this. I think in a world of fiction, maybe it doesn't matter that it doesn't look that realistic. And in fact, one of the instructions was to the designer was to make things, I can't remember how they put it, non-solid. It was to make a lot of the plots are non-solid. So the fact that that looks like a fairy tale painting of the castle is fine. And
that's good.
Perhaps all the better for it.
Mm. And then we get the Doctor and Zoe... they're shot at, aren't they? They kind of duck down behind this rock, and they kind of look up again, and Zoe says, oh, it's the carcass, which turns out to be like a fictional character from Zoe's time, who's got this kind of big gun that he's just fired at them with. She describes this gun, but the Doctor doesn't know who this character is. The Doctor says, oh, that's nonsense, that can't possibly exist, so the gun promptly disappears, which I thought was quite amusing. And we then get this quite comical fight scene between the Doctor, Zoe, and the carcass, where the carcass kind of is growling at them a lot, and Zoe keeps kind of throwing the carcass around. It's supposed to have superhuman strength. She didn't want to break through that paper top to the jam jar, because it would have used up her enormous strength that she uses to fight in here, because she's throwing it all over the place, isn't she?
It's a bit of a disappointing point. I mean, he's this muscle-bound superhero, isn't he, with a terrible cod German accent. Yeah, I mean, he's lost his weapon, his anti-molecular ray disintegrator. As you say, the Doctor said it's a scientific impossibility, so it disappears. And then they have this fight where she performs the same basic throw on him about five times, which he kind of walks into. And despite his superhuman strength, he gets his ass kicked by a girl.
Literally, she kicks him at the ass.
Yeah, she does at one point.
Yeah, she throws him around a few times. It's a bit like Emma Peel from The Avengers, isn't it? She's even wearing the catsuit for it. So.
Yeah.
And she eventually sort of grabs him around the neck and makes him kind of submit. He sort of shrieks like a girl himself. And then he submits and says he's her slave. The Doctor, meanwhile, is just kind of rushing around trying to avoid getting knocked over in the melee.
At one point, isn't he tries to do the same throw on the carcass, doesn't he? He gets absolutely nowhere with it.
Yeah.
Which is quite a funny moment. But there is some dialogue, isn't there, during this fight? But the carcass is just roaring throughout, so you can't really hear. But Wendy Padbury is desperately trying to say something about lessons, isn't she? Lesson number 35 and... Oh, that was lesson 72 or something like that.
Oh, right.
So she's trying to demonstrate that she learnt these moves somewhere in the academy or whatever. But all that is completely lost through the growling of the carcass, who incidentally is played by the same bloke who played the cyber leader in Revenge of the Cybermen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Christopher Robbie, who played the highly emotional cyber leader, didn't he?
Yeah.
In Revenge of the Cybermen. But it's a big fella. But still beaten up by a tiny girl.
Anyway, so he kind of submits to him, and Zoe sort of asks the way to the Citadel.
There's an interesting point about the carcass, isn't it? And that was Zoe was explaining to the Doctor that he was fictional, but because the Doctor had never heard of him, he couldn't say for certain whether he's fictional or not, and therefore he couldn't kind of banish him.
Exactly.
So that was at least a slightly different twist on the same
way. Yeah, exactly. So they got a different twist to him, which is good. They'd already used it. The original twist three times already. So
already spent.
So anyway, once he's submitted, he will do whatever they ask. So they ask him to sort of take him to the master's citadel, which he promptly does. Yes, yeah, she explains that he's a stripped cartoon character from her time, doesn't she? And they follow him to this sort of door where Zoe kind of dismisses him and he kind of wanders off, leaving him outside this door. The doctor basically just rings the bell and then he pretends that he is the carcass, gives the carcass his name and his attribution, and he kind of hides behind his cloak and manages to convince this door to let him in, which it probably does, so they go inside.
That's right, and the Doctor and Zoe come in to find Jamie and Gulla in that room in Rapunzel's Tower, appeared to be Rapunzel's Tower. The Doctor realises there's a light beam at the entrance, which they have to get over to enter the room without setting off the alarm, which is what Jamie had done earlier, wasn't it? He'd set the alarm off. And so they do jump over this light beam. Despite Gulliver's advice, the Doctor decides that he's going to take on the Master rather than giving in. Jamie shows them the ticker tape machine, and the Doctor realises that the Master's plan is actually to make them become fiction as well.
Mm.
And this seems to excite Zoe so much that despite being desperately clever, she wanders straight up to the light beam and sets it off. And interestingly, Gulliver didn't set it off when he left the scene a bit earlier because he's fictional.
Mm.
Zoe at this stage isn't, so she sets it off. The Doctor decides, you know, when this alarm's going off, he decides that they should just wait and be caught so that they can actually meet the Master. And sure enough, the white robots turn up and herd them through a door, and the Master is heard to welcome them.
And they go through and it cuts to another scene where they're behind another sort of set of doors, but these are sort of semi-transparent doors, aren't they, which open into the Master's control room. And we see him for the first time from the front. We've seen sort of the back of his head a few times, haven't you? But he's just kind of a little old man with glasses and white hair. And he wears a skull cap, doesn't he? And he's actually kind of connected to this bizarre kind of globe machine thing behind him with lots of kind of machinery inside it. Sort of, it's rotating, isn't it? And he's got these kind of leads attached to his head. And he kind of greets them. He's got dossiers on all of them. And he's sort of telling them about themselves and what have you. He congratulates them on passing all of his tests. And then he starts to tell them a little bit about himself, that he left England in the summer of 1926. He'd actually been brought to this place himself. And yeah, it's quite interesting, this bit, I think. It's a strange contraption that he seems to be attached to, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a sort of revolving sort of glass series of globes inside each other and all this kind of strange sort of fibre optic type stuff. Or something, just kind of, you know, all these little bits and pieces in there, aren't there? It's quite incongruous, because he's almost sort of Edwardian dress, isn't he?
Yeah.
But with all this circuitry coming out of his head. And the character is based on Frank Richards, who wrote all the Billy Bunter, Grey Prize stuff, and loads of other school and adventure stories for boys comics, you know, like The Gem and The Magnet and stuff like that. But he declares that he used to write for, is it The Ensign, he said, didn't he, the name of this?
Yeah, he writes for a serial magazine. I think you're right.
The one he holds up does have a picture of Billy Bunter on the front.
Oh, right, I didn't pick that up.
Yeah, I noticed it, and it's also mentioned in the info text. But,
yeah.
But I used to read all that stuff, so it's quite familiar to me. But there's a quite disquieting thing about this character, I think. He seems to be quite heavily made up, doesn't he? He's got quite dark makeup on, and I think the lines on his face are kind of accentuated with dark makeup. But they seem to miss the corner of his mouth, which is white, isn't it? And the rest of it isn't.
Yeah, it makes him look as if he's kind of frothing, doesn't it?
Yeah, and actually that's another testament to the remastering of this, because it used to make me feel quite sick when I watch this on VHS. Cause you know, some people get sort of clag at the corner of their mouth.
Yeah.
I thought he had it, and I thought and it used to make me feel a bit ill when I used to watch it, but I don't feel so bad now.
Anyway, he tells him about, you know, that he's been brought here and he's a writer and all this kind of business. And he says that his brain keeps this whole operation going, but that he answers to a higher power. And it's obviously this machine. And from now on, he switches between this kind of nice guy image when he's just talking to them. And he occasionally gets taken over by this machine, doesn't he, or this other power. And, you know, he switches between nice and nasty.
Yeah, he suddenly starts to... you know, barking out orders aggressively, doesn't he? Yeah, it's quite interesting. And at one point later on, he actually has a conversation with himself like that, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
But the camera is not on the human character at the time, so they get away with it. But while he's describing his situation, how he's implanted in his mega brain, Zoe and Jamie have slunk off into his library, which is again more of these photographic flats, this time showing a bookcase. But he then reveals that his imagination is the powerhouse for this higher power, but he's getting old and he wants the doctor to take over his position.
Yeah, he said he likes it there, that he liked, you know, all the books. Apparently it's got all the masterpieces from Earth writers, specifically Earth, isn't it, that he talks about?
Only Earth, it seems.
Mm. As you say, Jamie and Zoe have kind of wandered off and tried to escape. The doctor doesn't know. In fact, he tells them not to, doesn't he, but they creep off. But yeah, the master says that he wants the doctor to take his place because he's getting old. So this becomes kind of the crux of this story, really, that's why the master the doctor's been brought to this place, really, to replace the master and become the brain of the land of fiction.
Yeah, he seems to have passed enough of these tests, you know, and displayed, I guess, imagination to do so, and that makes him appear to be an ideal candidate to take over from this comic book writer. So, yeah, that's when you realise what it's all about. And the doctor refuses to take over, and his brain goes nuts. And talking through the master, he tells Doc there's no alternative, you will take over, and that's that. Meanwhile, the white robots capture Zoe and Jamie in the library. And now suddenly they have a bargaining chip against the doctor, and he says, all right, your life for theirs. And while the doctor's thinking about it, the white robots herd Zoe and Jamie into the centre of this giant book, which then begins to close as the episode ends.
Yes, and we move into the final part. So the book actually does close, and Jamie and Zoe kind of disappear inside it. And the master says that they've now become fiction. That if the doctor takes his place, the first thing he can do is to release them. But the doctor basically still refuses to do it. So the master calls in the robots again to try and force him to take his place. But when they come in, the doctor kind of legs it up some stairs, which suddenly appear from nowhere.
I think it's a bookcase he climbs up, isn't it?
It's not really clear, is it? Because he kind of climbs into the camera.
Into
the
camera, yeah. I think it's a bookcase in front, but yeah, it's not clear.
Yeah, and the master kind of says, oh, you know, let him go. I'm quite happy to play the doctor's game a little longer. You see the doctor appear from this door, and he's kind of on the ramparts at the top of his castle, isn't he? And Jamie and Zoe appear, and they start talking about the TARDIS breaking up. And they keep repeating the same thing over and over again. The doctor realises that it is true. They have been turned into these fictional characters.
Yeah, I think they only say things that they've said before during the course of the story, don't they?
I think so, yeah.
And Jamie's insistent about the TARDIS breaking up, but I think Zoe also only says stuff that she's already said. The doctor realises something's up, doesn't he? And then, you know, crumbs, you know, the master was right. You know, they are fictional. But then he sees his skylight, doesn't he, on the rooftop. And he looks through it and he sees a typewriter, which is kind of working itself. You know, I used to get the football results, didn't you?
A Vidi printer.
Vidi printer. but instead of football results, this appears to be the master tape or, you know, the whole story of what's going on at the time. But he can't get the skylight open and he wishes he has the strength of the carcass.
Yes, that amazing strength. Yeah, he could have just asked Zoe to get it. She was standing it. Anyway, yeah, when he says that, the carcass just appears in a flash.
A comic book flash, yeah.
Yeah, and he removes this skylight for the doctor, and then he also goes and fetches Rapunzel so that the doctor can use her hair to lower himself down into this room with the typewriter. She's quite accommodating with her hair, isn't she, old Rapunzel?
She is. She's a good one.
Yeah, definitely.
She got heart of gold, that one. And hair of gold.
Although the size of it, or the girth of her hair, keeps changing each shot. So when he's lowered himself down in the room, it's really quite thick. But when she's kind of on the roof, it's much thinner.
Maybe she's experimenting with various different products.
Possibly, yeah.
I mean, you can get some that really give your hair quite a lot of body. But anyway, the doctor's down in this little room underneath this skylight. And he gets to work on the machine, and he's writing that the enemy is defeated. But he's about to say that he did it, and then realises if he writes himself into this typewriter, then he writes himself into fiction, which is what the masters wanted him to do all along. And when the master realizes, the doctors realize this, he really loses his patience and he says they will play games no longer.
Yeah, the doctor climbs back up out of this room, and when he gets there, Jamie and Zoe have disappeared, but Gulliver and the annoying children appear again.
Or the annoying Gulliver and the annoying children.
And they all start kind of shouting at him for some reason. Meanwhile, the master is convincing Jamie and Zoe, or the fiction of Jamie and Zoe, that the doctor is a monstrous and cunning villain. He gets them to repeat that. I'm not quite sure how this is used. Oh, no, they do kind of trick him, don't they, a bit later.
Pretty much straight away, don't they?
The
TARDIS appears on the rooftops, and Jamie and Zoe come out. Do they come out of the TARDIS?
Yeah, they do come out.
And they're trying to beckon the doctor in, and but they're acting a little bit oddly and speaking unnaturally, aren't they? And they kind of drag the doctor towards the TARDIS and then push him in, don't they? And the door shuts, and they start cackling evilly and then kind of slinking back away from it, don't they? And at that point, the kind of facade of the front of the TARDIS falls away to reveal the doctor trapped in this glass box, which then disappears, taking the doctor with it.
And he reappears inside the master's control room, still in his box. Yeah, the master tells him that he's had to revert to plan B, which is to incorporate the doctor into the master computer itself. The plan is that they're going to bring the whole of Earth under his control. The humans' minds will be adjusted to suit his purpose, to which the doctor's response is, sausages! They'll all be turned into a string of sausages with no thoughts of their own.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's brilliant, and it seems like a very odd response. It's bellow sausages at him. Initially, it sounds like some arcane Gallifreyan swear word. This bit, I thought, jarred a little bit. I don't really think the whole taking over Earth bit is necessary, do you? I mean, the story's powerful enough without Earth having to be dragged into it, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the plight of the three main characters being turned, you know, into fiction is enough.
He doesn't always have to save the Earth, doesn't he?
And I think exactly. This isn't the new series, you know. You don't have to throw hammer and tongs at every story.
Right. Yes, but at this point, although that sounds like a terrifying situation, the Doctor realises that now he's actually part of the Master Brain. He can actually use the power he now has to take on the Master in what he describes as a battle of wits. And he immediately starts trying to contact Jamie and Zoe and telling them to break free of the book, because the real Jamie and Zoe are still trapped in this book while the fictional ones are wandering around grinning evilly.
The Master does a quite good impression of Trouton here. Is, Oh no, you can't do that.
Mild panic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Zoe and Jamie appear to hear the Doctor, and they give a final push and break free from the book, but the Master sends some clockwork soldiers after them.
Yes, and then we get this kind of, the Master and the Doctor are trying to better each other to win this kind of battle. So the Doctor calls on the carcass to rescue Jane and Zoe from the soldiers who are kind of bearing down on them. So the carcass kind of appears and shoots them. And the Master's response, he tells the carcass to turn on Jamie and Zoe and to attack them. But the Doctor counters that with saying that the carcass's gun's power has run out. So the Master thinking, okay, what am I going to do next? So he conjures up Cyrano de Bergerac, who's going to kill everybody who says he's got a big nose. And the Doctor counters that with D'Artagnan, and then we have a sword fight between the two of those.
One of the kind of victims to the low budget on this one was incidental music, which they had planned, some, I think, some orchestral stuff, which didn't happen because of money reasons, but they do use a bit of stock classical music. It's a bit of Bruckner that they use for this sword fight. And it works very well, actually. It makes it quite dramatic.
Meanwhile, while there's this distraction going on, Jamie and Zoe use Rapunzel's hair to escape, and they drop down into this chamber with the typewriter, don't they? Although that somehow links to the Master's control room, I think, because a bit later they appear there, don't they? So the Master, realising that Cyrano is losing out to D'Artagnan, replaces him with Blackbeard, the pirate, who immediately knocks the rapier from D'Artagnan's hand. But before he can chop D'Artagnan in half, the Doctor turns him into Sir Lancelot in full armour, on a horse.
who unsurprisingly wins.
Yeah. In the meantime, Jamie and Zoe have escaped. The overall controlling intelligence takes over the Master and calls for the Doctor to be destroyed. This is where you alluded to earlier, where the Master sort of has an argument with himself, because he obviously says, oh, well, no, but if you do that, there's no one to replace me, you know.
Yeah, they get around it, don't they, because you just see the kind of Master brain machinery, don't you? But because of the differences in the Master's voice that comes out of the machine is different from the voice that comes out of him as a person, isn't it? So as long as they keep him out of shot, you can actually do it effectively, and it does kind of work, doesn't it?
Exactly. The white robots appear, and yeah, the Master basically says, you know, change your weapons to destructor beams. Before, they were these strange things that caused a spirally effect that weren't really sure exactly what it was doing to people. But anyway, he tells them to change them to these destructor beams. The Doctor is removed from his brain machine. Jamie and Zoe have sort of crept in, and they're kind of hiding behind this big globe thing. And as the robots are about to kill the Doctor, well, they both jump up and they start pressing all the buttons on the computer, because I think they've heard the Master say something about, you know, not to overload the Master brain. So they think if they press all these buttons, that's exactly what it will do. And indeed it does.
Yeah, you get images of the unicorn and Medusa and various of the creatures that they've met that you're just kind of flashing through. And the control panel seems to be going haywire. Mm. And then the white robots, in an attempt to shoot the companions, end up shooting the control panel, don't they?
Exactly. Yet again, we get the finale as somebody's shooting the machine. but in the meantime, the Doctor kind of rushes over to the Master and removes his connections to his head. Mm-hmm. So he takes him out of the Master machine, and they all kind of make their escape. Jamie and Zoe, they help the Master, who's kind of slumps down when they remove him. And they kind of pull him out of the room as everything starts to explode. And they're kind of outside. You can still hear in the background things exploding. And the Master's sort of coming round. He doesn't remember anything. He thinks he's in the office of the magazine that he works for, doesn't he?
That's right.
He's very concerned about all the fictional characters and their fate. And the Doctor sort of says, well, they're fictional. What are you worried about? And then they all kind of clutch each other as as they tend to in the Troughton era. And as things exploding in the background, they start to fade. They're hoping that it will put them back where they belong. You know, they're hoping that it will send the Master home and they'll end up in the TARDIS. Everything fades, and then you get the final shot of the TARDIS, which kind of unexplodes. Kind of puts itself back together again, doesn't it? And the titles come up, which is a very strange ending to a very strange story, I think.
Yeah, and it's another cliffhanger, really, because it's not clear that the destruction of this Master brain is going to send them all back to where they came from. But next week's the invasion, according to the piece at the end. But there's actually a 3-week break because the 1968 Olympics were taking the place of Doctor Who for the next 3 weeks. So there was a pause in the middle of the season there. So, yeah, as you say, a strange ending to quite a strange story.
Yeah, but a good one. I mean, I think I enjoyed it. There's a few things that I didn't like about it, but there's enough in there for it to be very, I think it's pretty strong. Certainly very different to most other stories. Like I say, I think the only similar one you'd probably point to is Celestial Toymaker, which you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, there's that. Certainly at this stage, I think this kind of idea appears again, doesn't it, later on in the show's history. But certainly at this stage, probably the only thing that's been like it before is Celestial Toymaker. Although the first part reminded me quite heavily of Edge of Destruction, all that kind of in the TARDIS with weird stuff going on and knowing what's happening. Yeah, I think a kind of a very interesting first episode and a good idea. The whole idea, I think, is very good and very original. There's a whiff of The Wizard of Oz about it, isn't there, with the little old man behind all this stuff, but not enough to detract. I think the idea is good.
Yeah.
It is overlong. You know, we know why that is. There's an extra episode in there, really. And it is repetitious. I mean, the unicorn, the minotaur, the carcass's gun, and to an extent the Medusa are all dealt with in exactly the same way, aren't they?
They are, and you get, as you say, you get Gulliver coming back, you know, every sort of 15 minutes and doing, you know, exactly the same thing as he's done throughout. Occasionally he says something that slightly moves the plot on, but not really. But, you know, having said that, I mean, I do like his character.
You see, I don't particularly. I had an inward groan every time Gulliver turned up, to be honest. And although I think the story idea is pretty good, I think the supporting characters are mostly pretty poor. The carcass is fairly dreadful, I think. And Rapunzel's not one thing or another, really. She's very two-dimensional.
Yeah, doesn't do that.
No, I think the Master's quite good.
Yeah, I think he's the best of the lot. I think he's quite a good semi-villain, I guess.
As you say, Wendy Padbury's probably her most pantomime in this one, isn't she? Fraser Hines is okay, but and this is a terrible Who taboo.
Who taboo?
But I actually thought that Hamish Wilson almost did a better job of Jamie than Fraser Hines. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that or not.
No, you're not. Detracted immediately.
Sorry. What have I said?
I mean, he's okay. I mean, he doesn't do anything wrong. It's perfectly passable. I think it was a brave move to do that, really.
Well, it's very clever. Then he was forced upon them, wasn't it? It's a very, very clever way of doing it. And he certainly doesn't disgrace himself. No, it's unfair to say he's better than Fraser Hines, but he certainly doesn't disgrace himself.
I wonder what they would have done, because without that bit in the second episode, what would they have done to fill the time, you know? Because, you know, they've obviously added that in as a, oh no, what we're going to do, we're going to have to put something in there to explain it, which they've done well. But perhaps they did something else that they just dropped, I don't know.
Yeah, but probably something had to be sacrificed to make way for that. But the design work is pretty good, I think. The giant book, I think, is very effective. And the white TARDIS is a really nice image.
Mm.
The robot's pretty good. And the Medusa isn't bad, and particularly the stop-motion snakes on her head. Master's control room is quite well realised as well, I think.
Yeah, I think it looks pretty good. It's a strange one, because it kind of, at times it feels like you're watching a kids' programme, which, yeah, I guess you are, really, but a lot of the time Doctor Who doesn't feel like that. It feels much more childish, this episode, than most others, I would say.
When you think that the next one is the invasion.
Yeah, exactly. If you could directly compare the two, you'd think, well, is this the same program?
Yeah, which I suppose is the beauty of the format in some ways. You know, it's so flexible. Back onto the design idea, I think the design side of things, I think there's a few things that let it down. The Minotaur, obviously, is a bit of a failure, I think.
Mm.
The carcass as well, the muscle stuff doesn't look quite right, does it?
It kind of looks like a comic book character, though. I don't think that's a problem. I think what they do with him is just have this superhuman strength and gets beaten up by a miniature girl. That's what's disappointing. It's not. I think he looks quite well, okay, really.
Okay, all right. Well, the name's a bit odd, isn't it? Carcass. I mean,
he's
almost as inanimate as the name describes. And so, incidentally, as I was typing up some notes for this one, obviously PC Dictionary didn't know what a carcass was, and out of curiosity, I just checked to see what options it gave you on the dictionary, and the only one that came up was quarks. Which is the robots from the previous story. Freaky, eh?
Very freaky.
But as I say, most of the design is good, and the stuff that looks like it's been painted, you think, well, maybe that's all right in this world of fiction.
Yeah, I think you've got a point with that, yeah. In fact, most of it you can just argue, you know, well, it's fictional. You can do what you want with it. And in a lot of ways, having that as a kind of backdrop for the story was probably a good idea, really.
Yeah, I should say, think about Troughton. I think Troughton is superb throughout this.
Yeah, I was going to say, what did you think of Troughton? I just love his mannerisms, isn't it? You know, some of the things he says is like, you know, he's, oh my god, oh no. He kind of borders on comic, but not, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, he seems to be as scared by the situations get in as the companions, isn't he? He's very cleverly played, the whole thing. I mean, his range is tremendous, I think.
It's
kind of deadly serious and sort of angry, quite convincing anger, which some of the other actors who play the Doctors haven't been that convincing when angry, have they?
Right.
Step up, Sylvester McCoy. But he's got it all, I think. He's a brilliant portrayal of the Doctor. And by the time you listeners out there listen to this, you may already have seen the first episode of Matt Smith, but Matt Smith seems to be quite taken with Troughton's portrayal. So I'm hoping that some of that's going to rub off on the way he plays the character. Because Troughton is just terrific. He really is excellent in this. And in all the others, he's in, as far as I'm concerned.
And his interplay with, you know, Zoe and Jamie is great. You know, the way they kind of bicker with each other, but in a nice way, not like the kind of the Sixth Doctor and Perry type bickering.
We were talking about last time, weren't we?
It's great. I think he's really good. It's a shame that there's so little of him around to see.
Yeah, that is a real shame. So which makes stories like The Mind Robber all the more important, doesn't it?
It does. Make the most of what we've got, I think.
Exactly, yeah. It's actually Wendy Padbury's favourite story that she was in, this one.
She gets quite a bit to do, doesn't she?
She does, yeah. So overall, how would you score it?
Well, I was looking at what I scored it about a year ago when I was kind of scoring all the stories. I gave it an 8. I don't know. I think I'd probably go 7.5. It's pretty good, but there's enough about it that's a little bit annoying as well. So I think, yeah, it's about 7.5, I reckon.
Yeah, I was going to go 6.5 myself.
Okay.
I do find the repetitious nature and Gulliver, I just have terrible groan every time Gulliver appears. Because they use basically the same tactics throughout to defeat the enemy. Again, it was another one. I watched it twice for the purposes of this podcast, and I really didn't enjoy it the first time, and I enjoyed it a little bit more the second time. It's a shame. I can't really put my finger on why. Certainly, I don't enjoy Gulliver turning up quite so regularly and not really adding anything to the story.
Mm.
And just some of it is just a little bit too childish and mildly embarrassing, I think. So I would go 6.5, but a very brave attempt. I suppose it's in a way, it's kind of in Web Planet territory. But I think it's more successfully realised in some ways than Web Planet was.
Yeah, I think it's better realised than that. I mean, you know, I think it's realised reasonably well. But, you know, certain things let it down. The whole feel of it just is a little bit too, as I said before, but I can't think of a better word for it, but a bit too childish.
On the subject of audience views on this, there's a bit of the info text on the DVD reveals that it didn't really go down that well at the time, and a lot of the viewers are saying it was just a little bit too childish and stupid, and it was clear that the audience at that point was much more keen in sort of hard science fiction than this kind of fantasy element. And although the production team were fairly happy with the story, they didn't want this kind of fantasy to be a regular feature of the show, and they were, this was a kind of an interesting one-off experiment, which I thought went pretty well, but not one they were going to repeat very regularly.
Mm. Yeah, when the viewing figures kind of ranged from 6.5 to, I think, 7.3 million was the highest viewers for it, which kind of compares to Colin Baker, doesn't it? The last one we're looking at was roughly the same, I think. So you can see there that it dropped away from the heights of the Hartnell stories. It had been quite a lot higher. And it was a bit on the wane, which we know that towards the end of the Troughton era, some were thinking that the War Games would be the final story, weren't they?
And you can see when you do as we did, we went through all the stories in order a few years back, didn't we? And you can see them running out of steam in this final Troughton season, I think.
Mm.
And you can see that things weren't going perhaps as well as they could have been in terms of the stories and the production, really. I think the regulars are still very good. But it's interesting to see that the actual percentage of the British population who saw the final episode was 13.3%, which you think is quite a high percentage of everyone in Britain.
It is.
It's about 9.6, I think it was, for how many people were watching ITV at the time. So they certainly won the ratings war.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah. Yeah, overall then, pretty enjoyable, but not outstanding, I guess is the way to sum it up.
Yeah, I think it's possibly worth buying because it's one of the rare Troughtons, and for the weird episode one.
Yeah, I think the first episode is worth seeing on its own, really. I mean, it's one of those kind of weird and wonderful episodes that is almost completely separate from the rest of the story, isn't it?
It is, really, yeah. And it's also worth watching the story for Troughton's portrayal, and also for the novelty value of having two Jamies as well, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
So yeah, it's well worth a look, but not one of my favourites.
Yeah, I concur. So what's next?
Yeah, my turn to choose the next one. And there's one Doctor in the classic series that we haven't looked at yet, Peter Davison.
Yeah.
So I'm going to choose a Peter Davison one for the next podcast number 8, and it's going to be The Visitation.
Good choice.
Yeah, I think so. So for me, it's one of the standout ones in Davison's reign, and I'm looking forward to watching it again.
Yeah, so am I. That's a good one to put in there to talk about, I would think. Interesting sort of setting for it, and quite good monsters there as well.
Yes, more of that next time. So there you have it. The next time we'll be looking at the Visitation. So if you've got any comments about that story, then get in touch with us at crinoid@mail.com. Or you can tweet us. Just look up Crinoid on Twitter and you can contact us that way. Or you can go to our blog site at crinoid.blog.co.uk. So if you've got any thoughts on the Visitation, share them with us. And if you've got any thoughts on the Mind Robber or what we thought about the Mind Robber, then head over there and tell us what you think.
Great. Well, without much further ado, we'll sign off and we'll talk to you again next time.
Yep. See you next time.
Celebration of the BBC's Doctor Who programme. And no copyright infringement is intended!
The podcast is complete. Excellent.